Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
All right, so we'll fix that during the luncheon break, Ms. Giannetti, to what I said. All right, so can we get Dr. Lapisada in here? We'll do a very brief voir dire of her.
Do you solemnly swear the evidence you have to the court in case you have marriage to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Yeah. All right. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
We're going to do a brief voir dire, okay?
Okay. No problem.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Jackson, foundation on just those two points, please. Sure.
Your Honor, for purposes of expediting, does the court wish to, for me to go through the foundation of the doctor's education, training, and background and experience, which is going to take a minute?
Yeah, no, just focus on the foundation for the dog bites and focus on the foundation for what's been termed to be perhaps biomechanical engineering evidence, those two areas. And if there is support or methodology in Dr. Lapisada's resume to point to exactly where that is. Okay? And I expect this whole voir dire should take no more than 15 minutes.
I'll do my best, Your Honor. Doctor, could you please state your name for the record? Spell your last name into the record, please.
Yes, Dr. Elizabeth Lapisada. That's spelled L-A-P-O-S-A-T-A.
Dr. Lapisada, what do you do for a living?
I'm a medical doctor subspecializing in forensic pathology.
Dr. Lapisada, I'm going to move very, very quickly past the bulk of your training and experience over decades. I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions. Where did you get your medical degree?
University of Maryland School of Medicine.
And do you have any subordinate degrees to your medical degree?
Yes, I have board certifications in anatomic and forensic pathology.
How long have you had those board certifications?
Like 35, 40 years.
Have you ever worked as a medical examiner in any capacity?
Yes, I have.
Have you ever worked as a chief medical examiner for any agency or governmental agency or state?
Yes, I have.
Describe that for the court, please.
I was a chief medical examiner for the state of Rhode Island for 12 years.
How many autopsies would you say in general that you have conducted yourself?
Over 3,000.
How many autopsies in your experience as a supervisor, in one capacity or another, would you say you've supervised over your tenure?
Over 7,000.
Of those 7,000 that you have supervised, have any of those dealt with motor vehicle incidents?
Many.
Have any of those dealt with motor vehicle and pedestrian incidents?
Many.
Give me an idea, if you have a number in mind, how many motor vehicle pedestrian autopsies you have been involved with, either directly or from a supervisory standpoint.
Hundreds, over 500 at least.
Do you have a significant background and training in the cause and manner of death?
Yes, I do.
Is that the main goal or the main job or duty performed by a medical examiner?
Yes, it is.
Is it also significant in terms of supervising other subordinate medical examiners who may work under your charge?
Yes, you have to make sure they're doing it right.
Is there a methodology that you have employed and that is standard in the industry to employ, including differential diagnoses and inferential thinking in terms of coming to conclusions related to manner and cause of death?
Yes.
Can you explain that for the court in brief, please? I know you probably have a very lengthy explanation.
Okay.
Do it as briefly as you can, with being as succinct as you can.
Okay. Certainly. To determine cause of manner and death, we look at scene investigation, autopsy findings, police and witness statements, and medical history. And using that information, we come up with a differential diagnosis or a list of things that might have happened to that person to cause them to die. And from that list, then we see where all the science and all the data, which one it supports. So we've looked at several different things. I always told my staff, I said, how can we be wrong? What else could this be? So you have to make what in medicine is called a differential diagnosis and then see what the facts support.
Did you employ a differential diagnosis in this case?
Yes, I did.
Do you have to be at the scene in order to understand or analyze information that you get in a police report or photographs or things of that nature?
No, then we use the police investigation and scene investigation, crime lab reports, photographs taken by the crime lab, by the police at the scene.
Have you qualified as a expert forensic and anatomical pathologist in other courts in Massachusetts and other states?
Yes, I have.
Approximately how many times would you say you've qualified?
Hundreds.
I want to talk for a specific second about a specific area of interest for the court. Were you provided information and photographs of John O'Keefe's arm and his arm injuries included with the rest of the autopsy information that you received?
Yes.
Were you asked to make a determination about the nature of the wounds specific to his right arms? I know that there's other injuries to Mr. O'Keefe, but I'd like to relegate your attention to the right arm.
Yes, absolutely. That's what the forensic pathologist does.
Without telling me what your opinion was, were you able to come to an opinion or conclusion about the source of those injuries?
Yes, I was.
What methodology did you employ to come to that opinion or conclusion, or those opinions and conclusions?
My experience and knowledge and training, along with the appearance of the wounds on the right arm, which fit a pattern, and then knowing that it fits a pattern, then I can try to look for, okay, what is the item that caused this pattern? And that would be part of the differential diagnosis that I've used for many, many years in making diagnoses and determinations.
Have you ever been trained in pattern recognition?
Yes.
In what capacity?
As a forensic pathologist and medical examiner, a large amount of our work has to do with recognizing pattern injuries, because that's so important, because it gives us an idea of what might have caused that injury. And then that's clearly of a lot of importance to the police and the investigators as they're trying then to say, well, what could have caused that injury? And so the forensic pathologist could say, well, I think it was X or Y. Then they can carry out their investigation armed with that information as to what might have caused the injury on the body.
Is there such a thing in the world of pathologists as medical literature or academic literature that deals with pattern recognition?
Yes.
Are you familiar with some or most of those publications?
Absolutely.
Have you ever yourself taught classes on pattern recognition?
Yes.
At what level? High school, graduate school?
At the medical school level.
How often have you taught courses on pattern recognition?
Oh, at least a handful.
When was the last time you taught a course in pattern recognition?
Let's see, last month.
Do any of the courses that you've either taken, well, let's take them one at a time. Have any of the courses that you've ever taken dealt with wound pattern recognition as it relates to animal wounds?
Courses that I've taken?
That you have taken.
It's part of our basic training and understanding of a forensic pathologist. The board exams we take test for that. Those injuries are described in our basic forensic pathology and medicine textbooks. They appear continually in our medical and scientific journals.
Is that an important skill set to develop, wound pattern recognition as it pertains to animals as a forensic pathologist?
Absolutely.
Do any of those academic courses that you've either taken or reference works that you just referred to, do any of those deal with dog bites and claw marks specifically?
Oh, yes, they do.
In the course or courses that you have taught related to wound pattern recognition, have you ever taught on the subject of dog bite wounds and the recognition of dog bite wounds?
Yes, I have.
When was the last time you did that?
It would be in the course for in the medical school. Would have been several years ago.
Doctor, with regard to staying with dog bite wounds specifically, have you ever performed an autopsy that specifically dealt with dog bite wounds, known dog bite wounds?
Yes.
So you've seen them in person?
Yes, I have.
Have you ever been qualified in any court in the land, state or federal court, on the issue of wound pattern recognition as it pertains to dog bites?
Yes.
When was that?
The last one I can recall was a federal case involving questions of a police dog.
Did you engage, in that case, did you engage in a differential diagnosis to determine, in your opinion and conclusion, your expert opinion and conclusion, the source of those of the wounds that you saw?
Yes.
Did the court qualify you to speak on that issue in court?
Yes.
Did you, in fact, testify in furtherance of your opinions and conclusions in that case?
I did.
I want to turn for a second to motor vehicle accidents or motor vehicle incidents. Do you also, some of the same questions, have you also performed autopsies on known motor vehicle pedestrian incidents?
Yes.
How many times would you say you've performed an autopsy on those issues?
Hundreds, maybe even 1,000.
Is that a relatively common occurrence, as sad as it may be, motor vehicle pedestrian incidents in the field of forensic pathology?
Yes, it is, unfortunately.
Have you performed autopsies personally as well as supervised autopsies on motor vehicle pedestrian incidents?
Yes.
And what methodology do you employ in furtherance of coming to opinions and conclusions regarding cause and manner of death specific to motor vehicle pedestrian incidents? Mm-hmm.
We look at the scene investigation, we look at what the motor vehicle looked like, we look at the hospital records, the autopsy, and then trying to understand how the injuries that the pedestrian sustained, what those mechanisms were, and how the injuries show that that person interacted with the motor vehicle.
In doing so, in coming up with injury mechanism analysis, is it important to look at and analyze the actual vehicle that is allegedly involved?
Yes, you want to look at photographs of that or see it in person.
Is that part of the normal methodology that is employed in the field?
Yes, you must look at the photographs. You must see what the vehicle looks like.
Do you also look at the other side of that handshake? In other words, look at the body of the individual that was in your case, killed the decedent in order to marry the two and determine whether or not the cause and manner of death had something to do with the motor vehicle, a motor vehicle impact.
Absolutely.
Describe that for us, please. What are some of the things that you look for that's part of the normal methodology that a forensic pathologist employs?
Well, when we examine a fatality from a motor vehicle, we want to try to understand what led up to it, how the impact occurred, and then what happened after. So we would study information about the injuries to see if we can relate them to certain pattern injuries that would be on the car. There are also evidence of transfer of energy and injuries that can result from the transfer of energy. So using the body, looking at the scene and the vehicle, understanding the motions of the vehicle and how they would have produced or would not have produced certain injuries on the body.
I'm going to take them one at a time. With regard to animal wounds or dog bites, were you able, in this case, using differential diagnoses, using inferential thinking, and using the skills that you've developed over decades of your education, training, and background, were you able to, without telling me what the conclusion is, were you able to come to a conclusion or opinion as to whether or not the wounds that you saw on John O'Keefe's right arm were consistent or inconsistent with a dog bite or claw marks?
I was able to come to a definite scientific conclusion.
And is that conclusion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Is it to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes, it is.
Is it consistent with the training and methodology that you've employed over decades?
It is.
I'm going to ask you the same series of questions with regard to the motor vehicle incident. Did you review the autopsy report in an effort to look at John O'Keefe's entire body and all of the injuries that he sustained, not simply his right arm?
I looked at everything.
In doing so, were you able to come to an opinion or a conclusion as to the mechanism of injury and whether or not his injuries in total were consistent or inconsistent with a motor vehicle incident or impact?
I was able to come to a scientific conclusion.
And without telling me what that scientific conclusion is at this point, did you employ the same methodology that you've explained to the court earlier concerning differential diagnoses, inferential thinking, and decades of training, the education, training, and background that you've described for the court in coming to your conclusions about whether or not the cause and manner of death was consistent or inconsistent with a motor vehicle impact?
Yes.
Your Honor, is there any area that I have not covered to the court's satisfaction?
So I'll let Mr. Brennan ask questions. I may have a couple of questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. LaPosada.
Good afternoon.
If we could start with dog bites.
Yes.
Did you have any specific training in wound pattern recognition regarding dog bites?
Yes, it's in our literature standard textbook. It's standard information that is needed to be a forensic pathologist.
When did you receive training regarding pattern recognition of dog bites?
Beginning when I took my board, starting in 1983.
And what did that entail?
It entailed reading literature. It entailed reading the standard forensic pathology and medicine textbooks. And it is a subpart of understanding pattern injuries. Dog bite injuries are described in all our journals and all our standard forensic textbooks.
Other than reading about it when you were studying for your boards, did you have any practical experience where you were engaging in the field in pattern recognition analysis regarding dog bites?
Yes, yes. I've had many cases where there have been dog bite injuries.
When you were studying for your boards, were you doing that or after you completed your boards?
I'm telling you that it's such a basic part that during studying for boards, it's a section that we study. And I, of course, had many cases since then.
Did you receive any education past reading literature for the boards where you took classes, seminars, where it taught specifically wound pattern recognition regarding dog bites?
It's all part of wound pattern recognition. It's usually included in literature If there are lectures about patterned injuries, it's a subset of patterned injuries, like hammer injuries, like gunshot wounds, like baseball bat injuries. There's a huge number of types of patterned injuries that are part and parcel of what a medical examiner has to understand and diagnose.
Do you remember taking any specific classes or any specific training about wound pattern recognition relative to specifically dog bites?
Yes, it's in all the literature that I keep up with.
Did you take any training or did you attend any classes that involved wound pattern recognition of dog bites?
Yes, it's often included in our seminars and case reports.
Do you list any of those classes or seminars on your resume?
That I took? No.
Can you identify one of those classes, where it was, when it was, who taught it, what the name of it was regarding wound pattern recognition relative to dog bites?
I can't give you a specific time and date.
Can you remember the name of the last class or seminar that you took or completed that has to do with wound pattern recognition relative to dog bites?
I can't recall.
Is there anything in your report that identifies any of your specific education or training on wound pattern recognition as it relates to dog bites?
It's in my CV. It's basic knowledge that a forensic pathologist has to have.
I will ask you about the CV, but Dr. Lapasada, I just wanted to ask you about your report first. Is there anything in your report that points to any specific training?
In the report that I wrote on this case?
In your report relative to wound pattern recognition as to dog bites. Is there anything in your report that identifies that for us?
In my report, I put together the case of what happened to Mr. O'Keefe.
Okay. As far as your experience, though, do you ever make any note in your report about your specific experience and training about wound pattern recognition for dog bites in your report?
No, it's not appropriate.
Okay. In your CV, is there any way you can point to us where you had specific training for wound pattern recognition relative to dog bites, where we can see that on your CV?
No, it doesn't say dog bite training specifically, no.
Do you have anything on your CV that specifically talks about wound pattern recognition for animals?
Those are usually classified within other pattern recognition.
Do you have anything specific that would alert us in your CV that you've had such specific training on wound pattern recognition for animals?
Other than I've passed my board exams and have practiced for 40 years.
Have you provided a list of cases where you have testified in court specifically about wound pattern recognition of dog bites?
I don't know if I have given a list. I don't keep those kinds of lists.
You mentioned one case about law enforcement dogs in federal court. When was that case?
Several years ago.
How long would you say, if you had a guess?
How long was it ago?
Yes, please.
A couple years, around COVID time.
Okay. Did you testify in that case about law enforcement police dogs?
I testified about a individual who had injuries, and there was a question as to whether Canine Caper, who was the dog's name, inflicted any injuries on this person.
And this was in Boston Federal Court?
Springfield, yeah, Boston, right.
Is there a difference between law enforcement dog bites and domestic dog bites?
They have the same kind of dog jaw.
They're
taught differently, obviously.
Would the wound pattern recognition be the same or different if you were looking at it from a law enforcement dog perspective or a domestic dog perspective?
The dog would be the same.
Do you have any other cases that you've testified about wound pattern recognition relative to dog bites?
I've testified in hundreds of cases. I can't say that I remember any particular ones.
Would you be able to identify any of those for us today?
No, too many.
I'll ask you about accident reconstruction experience. And I mean this respectful, you don't have a biomechanical or a medical engineering type background, do you?
No, I'm not a mechanical engineer.
And you're not certified by ACTAR or any of those type of organizations, are you, doctor?
No, I relate the injuries on the body to the motor vehicle.
Have you ever been to a car collision scene and investigated a car collision scene firsthand?
Yes.
And when you've done that, do you have a chance to look at all of the physical materials, the properties?
Well, when I go to a scene of a motor vehicle fatality, I look at the pieces that are scattered around. I look at the body. I look at blood stain patterns. I look at damage to the car. And then the body would go back for the examination at the medical examiner's office. And there would be further examination of the scene by accident reconstructionists and examination of the automobile by specialists who could figure out what motor vehicles do. So it's a part of correlating the injuries to the vehicle.
Have you, you've never written an accident reconstruction report yourself, have you?
No, that's not what I do.
I understand. In this case, what materials did you look at? Because I don't think in your report mentions the materials that you studied. What materials did you study as the basis for any potential opinions regarding accident reconstruction?
Well, you would like for me to tell you everything I studied in this case?
Yes.
I have my list here. Should I read
that? That's fine by me.
Okay. I studied the autopsy report, neuropathology report, toxicology, and associated paperwork from the medical examiner's office. I studied 104 autopsy and neuropathology photographs, 70 additional autopsy photos taken by Trooper Watson. I studied Mr. O'Keefe's medical records from the Canton Fire Department and EMS run sheet. I studied the Good Samaritan medical records that also included 35 photographs of the body. I looked at evidence of Mr. O'Keefe's clothing, blue jeans, t-shirt, sweatshirt, boxers, and sneakers. I'm sorry. I looked at photographs that were taken at the crime lab of various pieces of plastic, black, red, and clear. I studied photographs of the outside of Ms. Reed's SUV as it was parked at the police garage. I studied the Canton Police incident report, about 100 photographs taken by Canton Police of the outside scene. That gave me a very good idea of what happened to Mr. O'Keefe.
Were you involved in a case, Cromwell versus Daniel Tompkins?
Remind me about that. I've been involved in hundreds of cases.
Yes, you have. This case was in Franklin County Superior Court. It was a case where you had an opportunity to present testimony and regarding blood spatter, which you've been qualified expert for. I'm sorry.
Well, that doesn't quite say what I did, but I remember the case you're talking about.
Did you attempt, or was there an attempt to have you qualified to talk about accident reconstruction in that case?
No, I'm not an accident reconstructionist.
And do you remember whether or not there was an attempt that was denied to try to have you talk about accident reconstruction in that case?
I have no idea. I'm not an accident reconstructionist.
Okay. Do you have anything on your CV specifically that offers any background on accident reconstruction or accident reconstruction type classes or seminars?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Lapisada.
No, you're welcome.
So can I just ask Dr. Lapisada,
yes.
about, you said you've been involved in autopsies with dog bites.
Yes.
How many?
I've done thousands of cases, probably 50 or so. It's not always the cause of death. And then I've supervised maybe 75 more where that dog bites were involved in the case.
When was the last one?
Probably 2 years ago.
Okay. Any questions based on my questions?
No.
All right. You are all set. I'm going to ask you to step down, Dr. Lepisato. We'll get to you sometime this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
I do want to give everybody a break, including counsel. Can we do less than 5-minute arguments on this?
Okay. It's eminently qualified to speak to both the issue of wound pattern recognition as it relates to dog bites, specifically, as well as cause and manner of death as it relates to vehicle pedestrian incidents or impacts. The doctor has an incredibly impressive resume, just a touch of which we reviewed during the course of this voir dire for her qualifications. But with regard to the dog bite specifically, she talked about the differential diagnosis that she undertakes and undertook in this case. She talks about the inferential thinking that she undertook in this case. She talks about how that is the proper methodology in the scientific community and specific to the forensic pathology community in order to come to a determination about wounds and the source of wounds, i.e., was it a dog? Was it another animal? Was it another source? Was it lacerations versus abrasions? Things of that nature. She's obviously done, as she indicated, thousands, if not climbing real close to 10,000 autopsies that she's either supervised or that she's conducted herself. She actually has, notably, as per the court's last question, she's actually undertaken personally somewhere close to, I thought it was probably 5 autopsies herself dealing with dog bites. They're not always the cause of death, but sometimes it's attendant to the injuries that led to a different cause of death. But she's undertaken at least 50, or that's what she estimates, 50 of those autopsies herself. She's seen dog bites, she's seen dog wounds, she engages in pattern recognition. She also teaches classes on pattern recognition as it pertains to dog bites, and she's eminently qualified to speak to that in this particular case. She has been able to come to an opinion and conclusion as to whether or not the injuries to John O'Keefe's arm are consistent or inconsistent with dog bites, and I expect that she would then give that opinion and conclusion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty and to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. As it relates to her differential diagnosis and her ultimate conclusions concerning the automobile impact, obviously many, many, many more autopsies dealing with that because it's more common. She also engaged in the exact same differential diagnosis. She has training. The sub-field of, or the sub-issue of vehicle pedestrian impacts is included and subsumed within much of the medical literature that she's been taught on going all the way back to the 1980s, dealing with her boards, and she's consistently passed her boards. She's consistently kept up with the literature. She's consistently engaged in autopsies herself, so she has firsthand training. She also trains other medical professionals, other doctors, other medical examiners, and she supervises other medical examiners. She's been the chief medical examiner for an entire state. I cannot imagine somebody more eminently qualified to talk about the two subjects that she's been called to talk. Well, she's called to talk about several other subjects, but these two subjects that's before the bench right now, than somebody with Dr. Lapisada's qualifications. I will submit on the voir dire that we just completed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Brennan.
I do not think that Dr. Lapisada has articulated the experience the way it's been summarized. She could not provide any specific training other than her boards and her references to literature. She could not articulate one single class or seminar that she took that pertained to differential diagnosis of dog bite injuries. She has no specific memory of having any type of experience in differential diagnosis as far as being in a training, seminar, or advanced education. She has the experience of a medical examiner who has seen what she believes to be dog bites in the past. She has no publications or references that she has studied the issue of differential diagnosis or pattern wound recognition relative to dog bites. If we look at the standard Dr. Russell employed, Dr. Leposada does not have any of the merit to be an expert in dog bites. While she has taught, we did not hear about anything in particular that she has taught about specific pattern wound recognition analysis regarding dog bites. She is an experienced medical examiner, has a wealth of experience, past experience in autopsies, but she has no experience that is a basis for her as an expert in being a dog bite expert. Particularly, she mentions one case that she's testified in federal court that we've heard of today, and she has nothing whatsoever in her report or resume to establish that she has used, studied, and knows this methodology. In fact, her CV and her report don't have any basis for one to look at and see that she has any specific experience in dog bites. And so Dr. Leposada, from the Commonwealth's perspective, should not be able to give an opinion regarding or about whether or not the wounds on Mr. O'Keefe were caused by a dog. She simply does not have the training and experience and education and methodology to make her a so-called dog bite expert. Regarding accident reconstruction, she said it best. She is not an accident reconstructionist. She saw some of the materials in this case, but it is a fraction of the materials in this case. She is not in a position to give an opinion whether or not the wounds are consistent with broken taillight. There is nothing we see on her CV. There's nothing we see in her report. There's nothing we heard on direct examination that she has any experience in breaking glass, breaking plastics, and the causation of wounds. It also overlooks the fact that the opinion that would be offered would extend beyond just the wounds on the arm. It would extend to a general opinion that he was not involved in a collision, and that's improper. There's no predicate or basis for it. And so based on her testimony and absence of being able to provide any education or experience, she should not be able to testify about either of these two matters.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. She was, Mr. Brennan suggests that, well, she's only been qualified in one court, but a federal government, a federal judge that was handling that case qualified her as a dog bite expert in that case. That is not a small thing.
That, as a matter of fact, it's a very big thing for Dr. Leposada and her credentials. In addition, she indicated, contrary to what Mr. Brennan just suggested, she indicated that she has been training on wound pattern recognition as it pertains to dog bites for her entire career, not just when she was studying for her boards, since she's been studying for her boards. And it's been constant and consistent throughout her entire career. She's made these differential diagnoses. She's seen the autopsies. She's seen the wounds during autopsies firsthand, probably 50 or more. She's supervised another 75 or more autopsies dealing with known dog bite wounds. She has the credentials. The court will recall that, for instance, Dr. Isaac Wolf was called to testify by the Commonwealth. He had absolutely nothing, no credentials whatsoever to talk about wound pattern recognitions. He was a neurosurgeon, and yet he was allowed, over Mr. Alessi's objection, to talk about and to discuss his opinions and conclusions as to the wound pattern on the back of John O'Keefe's head. Certainly, Dr. Leposada brings much, much, much more to the table than Dr. Isaac Wolf. I'm not comparing them. They're apples and oranges. Dr. Leposada is the, she doesn't have to be a sole dog bite expert to be expert in dog bites. She doesn't have to be Dr. Russell. She just has to have that level of knowledge, that level of skill, that level of expertise that's beyond that of the average layperson in order to opine as an expert on a particular issue. She certainly brings that to the table as it pertains to dog bites, and I think her skill and her education, training, and background certainly speaks to to the fact that she has that in spades with regard to motor vehicle pedestrian incidents.
All right. I'll submit. Thank you. All right. I'll get your ruling as soon as I can. So we're going to stop back up at 20 past 2, and I expect to go straight through the rest of the afternoon.
All right, for the court, please. Back to session, you may be seated.
All right, I appreciate the court personnel waiting so that we could have that voir dire. It was helpful. All right, so my rulings are very similar than they were this morning. So first of all, on the Daubert analysis regarding Dr. La Passada being able to testify as to the dog bite wounds, I find that she is not qualified. I'm not satisfied that the Daubert requirements have been made, specifically not just the experience, but the reliability of the methodology she used and how it was applied. So based on that, she cannot testify to the dog wounds. And I want to take a minute to differentiate this testimony with Dr. Russell's. I found that Dr. Russell was an expert qualified to testify as to dog bite wounds, mainly from her experience in the ER, coupled with her being an ME. Dr. La Passada does not have that experience. I found that Dr. Russell's methodology was reasonable and was sufficient, and I found that it was appropriately applied. Remember that Dr. Russell was published in the area here. So regarding pages 10 and 11, all of the text on Dr. La Passada's report on pages 10 and 11 that start with the injuries on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm are excluded. Now moving on to the testimony regarding not being consistent with a motor vehicle strike, I find that Dr. La Passada's opinion on these not being the result of a motor vehicle collision exceed what is within her scope of expertise in some regards, not in all, in some regards significantly, like I said this morning. So on page 17, the first sentence is in, the second sentence, tail lights are typically made of durable polycarbonate or acrylic plastic. That is out. I know the Commonwealth objected to, but I'm letting in. Mr. O'Keefe's patterned injuries on his right arm do not correspond to injuries that could have been produced by irregular fractured plastic pieces impacting the arm. She cannot say tail light, but she can say that based on her experience. His arm had no tissue bruising from impact. That also comes in. And the next sentence, neither did his skin show any array of irregular, unpredictable, randomly scattered cuts and scrapes at various angles and depths. That's within her realm of expertise as a medical examiner. The next page, though, I may have said this morning that that first sentence, importantly, in review of that, in review of the Tompkins case, that first sentence stays out because to me, it seems like that sentence depends on a biomechanical analysis, factors such as speed and force and the position of Mr. O'Keefe. So that's, oh, I'm sorry, page 18, the next page regarding the same subject matter. And a portion of the next sentence is also out. This results in bruising or bleeding under the skin. That's out. But Dr. La Passada can testify that Mr. O'Keefe had no bruising on his arms or torso. And that's it for that sentence. In particular, Mr. O'Keefe did not have bruises on his legs as shown by dissection of leg tissue and muscle at autopsy. That's it for that. And the conclusions are problematic to the extent that is consistent with this ruling and what we discussed on Friday. So that's it. That was just the text of her report. I have not begun to go through all of the, there's no PowerPoint with this, Mr. Jackson, right?
There is no PowerPoint.
All right. Do you intend on displaying any of these photographs?
I'm sorry?
Do you intend on displaying any of the photographs that are in her report?
Yes. I have to go through it now, of course.
All right. So you likely not get to that today. We've wasted, we've done important work, but we've wasted an awful lot of the jurors' time today. So I want to bring them in. And
I have no problem with that. My suggestion, we have to finish with that.
Right. We're going to do that now. So that'll give you an opportunity to pull your thoughts together.
Right, and I expect what I would do is say, well, that's my intention. I will go through her submission. That will take me a good amount of time. I will go through the part of her initial analysis that will not include any of the photos, but I may be open to actually go through the court's ruling. It's very specific, and I want to be as
okay, so let,
as possible.
Let me know what you intend to put in. All right, and there's a lot of text describing the photos that is out, right? It's just hearsay.
I mean, we had Dr. Welch's PowerPoint.
That was not objected to. There's a big difference.
Yes, it was objected to.
So,
it was.
So let's, we'll deal with this tomorrow, with the photographs tomorrow.
I just want to let the court know, I'm not wasting the court's time.
Okay, thank you. And we're bringing the jurors in. Did the Commonwealth want to respond in any way?
No, thank you.
Okay. And you have, there's a motion on Dr. Rentschler. We will give that, I haven't read it yet. We'll give that no more than 5 minutes tomorrow morning each side. This jury, you can tell just by looking at this jury, they're fed up. So.
Your Honor, the only thing I want to put on the record is, with regards to the court's ruling, I do want the record to reflect that is obviously, it's over the defense objection.
Sure.
And I just want to make for the record a quick comment. The Commonwealth waited until June 5th to even bring this up, to file a motion regarding Dr. Babasada. They have a report and all reciprocal discovery was done in March 6th, 2025. That's document number 45.
Yeah.
And the Commonwealth was ordered to file whatever motions they wanted to, whatever motions in limine they thought were appropriate by March 7th. And they did not do that. They were supposed to be heard on March 18th.
Okay, so the jurors are coming in. We're going to mark the report.
Okay.
And the CV for identification.
I just need to know what point I can make.
You just made it.
I made it ish.
Okay. Okay.
The point is.
Go ahead, real quick.
The point is, the Commonwealth has not explained the delay
so,
in making this motion. They have, and we're playing by the same rules, Judge.
So the basis of my ruling was not late disclosure. Okay. Late disclosure. Commonwealth says they're part.
That's not the court's missing the point. It's the opposite. We got late disclosure that they were objecting. They've had since March to object. They blew the motion in limiting time, and then they come in just before Dr. Babasada testifies, and now they're sort of sandbagging this and getting court rules against us. So okay. I want to make sure the record is imminently clear about.
Very clear. Mr. Brennan, do you want to respond real quickly?
Your Honor, we can always object even during the proffering of testimony. There's no foundation. It's a foundational issue.
And that's consistent with what my rulings were when I allowed other witnesses to testify, that the defense could object if the foundation weren't properly laid. So bring them in, please.
Right, jury. Court is in session. Please be seated.
Jurors, you have been extraordinarily patient with us today. We're going to go straight through until 4 o'clock, and we're going to make every effort to not leave you waiting out there as long as you have, as long as we did today. All right, Ms. Giannetti, is your witness ready?
Mr.
All right, Mr. Tedeman, whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sir, before the lunch break, you had identified three entrances to the front of 34 Fairview, leaving aside the two garage car doors. Do you recall that?
Yes.
May I have that last exhibit displayed, please? Not that one, the one that we discussed right before court. There it is. Maybe zoom in on that a little. Okay, what do you see on the screen at this point, sir?
I see the two rightmost entrances to the house, excluding the main front door.
Okay, which would be obviously to the left
to
of
the
this
left.
Photo, particularly with regard to the third entrance, the one in red. Could you describe that?
Yes, so it's if you're facing the house from the street, you're looking towards the west. So that door goes directly into the garage facing north.
Okay, so basically from the street, you don't have to enter the house, you can go into the garage directly.
That is directly into the garage, yes.
All right, and as we're looking at the house from this point, are we looking at it from the vantage point of Fairview Road?
Yes.
And that is a westerly direction toward the house, sir?
Correct.
In the course of doing your further work that you were asked to do in this case, did you peer inside the garage?
Yes, I did.
Did you see concrete steps and a ridge there and a hard concrete floor?
Yes.
Sustain. Jurors, disregard that answer.
You mentioned that you were asked to do some measurements. Can you describe what you were asked to do for the jury?
Yes, I was asked to measure from basically the mailbox area of the driveway to the various entrances to the house.
Did you take those measurements?
I did.
Okay, if I'd like to take them one at a time. First, did you measure from the end of the driveway next to the mailbox all the way to the main front door, which is not depicted on this photo?
Yes, I did.
How did you measure it?
I used my wheeled measuring device. And I walked directly across the lawn to the front door, well, to the bottom of the front steps, and then used it to go up the front steps straight to the door.
And what was the measurement, if you recall, from the mailbox area near the end of the driveway to the main front door on the left?
I believe it was 65 feet 9 inches, but I have notes if I think
you got it right, sir.
Okay.
Did you measure from that same location near the street, the end of the driveway next to the mailbox, to the second front door, which is actually depicted in the exhibit that's on the screen?
I did.
And how did you measure that?
I walked along the edge of the driveway on the asphalt, right next to the grass, towards the house from the mailbox and the edge of the street, towards the house. I took a left onto the brick walkway, proceeded along that walkway, then took a right to the walkway that you can see right there, heading directly to the door, and went up onto the little decking area, and then those two steps directly to the doorstep.
Okay, so you walked essentially almost the whole length of the driveway?
Yes.
Before you took the left to get to where the steps start, going to that second front door?
Yes.
And then went up to the door itself?
Yes.
Do you recall from your memory what the measurement was?
I believe it was 70 feet 1 inch.
And finally, did you measure from that same end of the driveway near the street next to the mailbox to the red side door, which is the pedestrian entrance into the garage directly?
I did.
How did you measure that?
I did the same thing, walking directly from the where the mailbox and the driveway intersect, basically, all the way up the driveway, took the same left onto the red brick pathway, took a right to go towards the front door, went up the one step that you can see, and then instead of going up the next two steps, I took a right directly towards the garage entry door.
So essentially the same path of travel, it's just you didn't go straight into the second front door, you took a right to go into the pedestrian entrance to the garage?
Correct.
And what was the measurement that you discovered having done that?
I believe it was 78 feet 3 inches.
Now, finally, could we have displayed the map of Cedar Crest, Fairview, and Chapman? There it is. Sir, are you able to see the street names from where you are? And if
yes.
not, could we have the top street magnified so that the witness can see it? Okay, you see that?
I do.
What do you see that to be?
Cedar Crest Road.
Okay, if we could have the connecting street where the, that's it?
Fairview Road.
All right, and finally the one down the bottom?
Chapman Street.
Okay, if we can get the whole map back up. Having seen those three street names, does that orient you as to what this is a map of?
It does.
And what is that?
This is the surrounding area of 34 Fairview Road, the neighborhood, basically.
Okay, and it includes the two connecting streets on either end?
Correct.
Does the red dot symbolize anything for you?
It looks to be where 34 Fairview Road is located.
Okay. And if you're on Fairview Road to the right of that red dot as it exists on that exhibit, and you're looking toward Fairview Road, what direction would you be facing?
I'd be facing west.
If I may have a moment, Judge.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
You had a wheel to measure?
Correct.
And so there's like a tape measure, and when you wheel it out, it gives a straight line?
No, it's two wheels with a meter in between them, and you roll it out in front of you.
I see. Your first measurement was from the driveway to the front door?
To the main front door to the far left, yes.
And that was about 63 feet?
I believe it was 65 feet, something like that.
65?
I have my notes, yes.
So suffice to say, if you were to leave the front door and come back to that spot, it would be an additional 65 feet back, right?
Yes.
The second measurement was from the bottom of the driveway to the middle door on the side?
Yeah, the second front door, yes.
Did you say that was about 70 feet?
It was, yes.
Okay. And again, if you were to come back, that would be an additional 70 feet?
It would.
And the last one was the door near the garage. Did you say that was further, around 80 feet?
78 feet, 3 inches, I believe.
Except one way?
Correct.
And back is another 78 feet?
Correct.
When you measured these, was it from the asphalt of the driveway or to the left of the mailbox as you're looking at Fairview?
It was to the right of the mailbox on the asphalt, as close to the mailbox as I could get.
Did you happen to take any measurements from the flagpole to the front door as far as distance?
I did.
And what was that?
I do not have the exact measurement. I'm not sure.
Do you have it in a report that you
could
look
at? I don't. No, not with me.
How about the flagpole to the middle door on the side? Did you take any measurements of that?
I'm not sure I took that one.
How about the flagpole to the furthest away door, which would be the door next to the garage? Did you take any measurements of that?
I think I took a direct measurement to that, yes.
Right. What was that number?
I don't know.
Do you have a report you could share with us?
I don't. No, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Did you ever measure if you were at the flagpole area, how long it would take to walk up the street? How far would it be to walk up the street, up the driveway, any of those doors? Did you ever measure it that way?
I did.
And what was the distance if you were going to start at the flagpole, walk up the street, up the driveway, down the walkway to the front door?
I'm not sure that distance. Not positive the distance.
Was it over 80 feet?
It was.
And if you did the same route up the street, up the driveway, to the middle door, would you agree that would be well over 80 feet as well?
Can you repeat the question? How?
Sure. If you were to measure from the flagpole, up the street, up the driveway, to the middle door, that would be well over 80 feet?
Yes.
Same for the door next to the garage?
Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right, you are all set, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask the court to ask Dr. Elizabeth Lombosada to join us.
Okay.
Tell me, sir, the evidence you give the court and jury in the case now and here should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
I do.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
May I inquire?
Yes. And Dr. Lombosada, please speak right into that microphone, okay?
I will.
Thank you.
Doctor, can you please state your full name and spell your last name for the jurors?
Yes, Dr. Elizabeth Lombosada, spelled L-A-P... S-A-T-A.
I'm going to ask you, you have a softer voice. I'm going to ask you to pull that microphone right under your chin, if you don't mind. It's pretty adjustable.
Okay. Better?
That's better.
Okay.
That's better. Doctor, can you tell the jurors what you do for a living?
Yes, I'm a medical doctor, and I subspecialize in forensic pathology.
Can you summarize your professional background?
Certainly. I graduated in 1975 from Bucknell University with a Bachelor of Science in Biology. I went to University of Maryland School of Medicine, where I graduated in 1979 with a Doctor of Medicine. I did my internship and fellowship at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, where I studied anatomic pathology, which is the study of the diseases of the body. I then did my subspecialty fellowship in St. Louis in forensic pathology, which is understanding causes of death and injuries to the body.
Currently, are you a professor?
Yes, I am.
And tell us where you work.
I own my own independent consulting practice, and I'm also an associate professor at Brown University School of Medicine.
How long have you taught at Brown University School of Medicine?
Since 1993.
And how long have you been a clinical associate professor of pathology, either at Brown or before that?
Oh, gee, then that would have been since at least in the late 80s. I've been associate professors at the universities and medical schools where I've worked.
Doctor, at Brown University, let's take Brown first. What do you teach there?
I teach the second year medical students. I teach a lecture in diseases of the heart, cardiomyopathy, and myocarditis. And I've been asked to give some specialized lectures in toxicology and forensic pathology.
Are you responsible for training medical students in the field of forensic pathology?
When I was a chief medical examiner, yes, we would have medical students, residents, come into the office so they could learn about what we do to understand cause and circumstances of death.
When you first got your medical license, did you then undertake to get certain board certifications and the like?
Yes.
Before we get to those board certifications, did you begin a practice in forensic pathology in some way or another?
After I finished my medical school and my anatomic fellowships and forensic pathology fellowships, then I was working in medical examiner's offices where I was examining deceased people to understand how they died.
When you get a medical license, is that statewide or is it nationwide?
Usually you get a state medical license.
And do you hold a state medical license?
Yes.
How many?
I have an active medical license in Rhode Island where I have my consulting practice, and I have inactive license in Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, Pennsylvania.
And you've been previously, at least before they were inactive, you were licensed in all five of those states?
Yes.
You already told us a little bit about your college. Did you mention Bucknell University? Your Bachelor of Science degree?
I think I did, yes.
At some point after you graduated from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, did you complete any residencies?
Yes, I did my residency at at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore in anatomic pathology.
Forensic pathology is different from anatomic pathology, correct?
Yes.
Did you also do any kind of residency in forensic pathology?
Yes, I did a fellowship in forensic pathology.
And what is the difference between, if you can sort of take us through that little by little, what is the difference between forensic pathology and anatomic pathology?
Anatomic pathology is sort of hospital-based pathology where we understand diseases of patients who are in the hospital and try to make clinical pathologic correlations to see if their diagnoses were correct, if the laboratory tests actually showed what we find at postmortem. And then forensic pathology deals more with understanding why the body stops functioning at a particular time. So that would be cause of death. And that can be sudden unexpected death or death due to violence.
And in forensic pathology, is that often associated with testimony in court cases that may deal with either on the civil side or the criminal side, coming in and testifying about things like cause of death and manner of death?
Yes.
What types of cases did you work on during your forensic pathology residency?
Oh, sudden unexpected natural death, gunshot wounds, knife wounds, sudden infant deaths, blunt force trauma, skeletonized remains, decomposed bodies, strangulation, the whole gamut of ways people can die unnaturally.
And what type, to contrast that, what types of cases did you work on during your anatomic pathology residency?
There you're mainly dealing with natural diseases and understanding heart disease or how somebody gets pneumonia, or looking at the brain to understand if a stroke was present. And that's especially important then to the doctors who are treating those patients, that they can see if the diagnostic tests were appropriate or if their treatments worked.
You mentioned fellowship a little earlier in your testimony. What is a fellowship?
A fellowship is after you've done your internship and residency. A fellowship is more specialized training, and I did that in forensic pathology.
So answers my next question. You do hold a postgraduate fellowship position, correct?
Yes, yes.
And that was in forensic pathology specifically?
I'm board certified in anatomic and forensic pathology.
Were you a research associate at the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at University of Pennsylvania School of Law?
Yes.
I'm sorry, School of Medicine?
Yes.
Old habits.
Yeah.
What about postdoctoral research fellow? Were you ever a postdoctoral research fellow?
Yes, I did. I had an NIH research grant where I worked on how alcohol affects the heart.
Where was that?
That was at St. Louis University, and then when I was on staff at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
What about postdoctoral research fellow at dealing with the cardiovascular division of the Department of Medicine at Washington University?
Yes, that's where I did research on how alcohol affects the heart.
Was all this in furtherance of your broad education and training as a pathologist?
Yes.
I think you indicated that you have served as a chief medical examiner in answering one of the previous questions. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I was appointed chief medical examiner for the state of Rhode Island in 1993, where I was responsible for all unexpected, unnatural deaths or deaths that involve violence in the state of Rhode Island. So I had to supervise the office, made sure I have adequate staff, made sure my forensic pathology staff were doing a good job, made sure I had an adequate scene investigative staff. So running the whole office.
Is that the highest appointment in the OCME's office?
Yes, it is.
In that position, did you oversee every single medical examiner in the state of Rhode Island?
Yes.
Did you also hold a position as the co-chair of Child Fatality Review Committee in the state of Rhode Island?
Yes, as part of being chief medical examiner.
Tell us a little bit about that. What was that appointment?
Well, there's a, you know, a big concern about infants who die and children who die. So those are reviewed specifically by a group of doctors from the pediatricians and also then the medical examiner's office. So we look at every child and infant death.
How long did you serve as the chief medical examiner in the state of Rhode Island?
For 12 years.
Starting when and ending when?
Starting in 1993 and ending in 2005.
As the chief medical examiner for Rhode Island, did you ever have the responsibility to work on any mass disaster cases?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that, if you could start with the Egypt Air issue.
Yes. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. In 1999, the Egypt Air 990 was took off from New York Airport, and it crashed off the coast of Massachusetts, and 2,065 passengers died. And because of the force of the airplane going into the water, all the bodies were fragmented. So they were brought, all the fragments were brought to my medical examiner's office. They actually vacuumed the ocean floor, and we had 2,600 some fragmented remains from that airplane crash, and that involved working with FBI, TSA, to identify those individuals and understand exactly why they died.
What was your role and the role of your staff that you supervised in dealing with those other government agencies, the FBI, the NTSA, you know, other entities, in terms of the fatalities that you did review as a medical examiner or the chief medical examiner of Rhode Island?
Well, I dealt with families from around the globe who had relatives on that flight, and then the FBI was looking into what may have caused the crash. The Egyptian government, who owned the airplane, was also there and interested in understanding what happened. And we were also, you know, tasked with identifying everybody who was on the plane and to see if that matched the passenger manifest list. So were there people on the plane who shouldn't have been on the plane? So that sort of thing.
In terms of matching that manifest, were you the head of the department for the medical examiner's office that was responsible for trying to figure out who was on the plane and match those remains with the individuals that were on the manifest?
Yes, we made the positive forensic identifications and returned the fragmented human remains to their families.
Doctor, did you also deal with the tragic station nightclub fire?
Yes.
In what capacity did you deal with that?
Again, this was a nightclub that burned down. It burned down very rapidly with a very hot fire, and that was in Rhode Island, and there were 100 fatalities from that. So those come to the medical examiner's office. I had my investigator at the scene throughout that time of recovering the bodies, and I was charged with determining the identity and the cause of death.
Were you successful, or your staff successful, in determining the identity of most of those individuals who perished?
Yes, all of them. We worked around the clock for 3 days to get that done.
And you were the head of that task force. Before you became the chief medical examiner in Rhode Island, did you previously work as a medical examiner under somebody else?
Yes.
Tell me about that. What was your first post as a assistant medical examiner?
My first post was after I did my fellowship training in St. Louis, Missouri. I was an assistant medical examiner for the city of St. Louis.
Were you ever an assistant medical examiner in Philadelphia?
Yes. So after St. Louis, I moved to Philadelphia, where I was on staff at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and I ran the autopsy service there at the hospital, and I was also an assistant medical examiner for the city of Philadelphia. After that, I was an assistant medical examiner for the state of Delaware, and then I came to Rhode Island as I was chosen to be chief.
Dr. La Posada, can we put dates on that? Assistant medical examiner in St. Louis from when to when? Do you remember?
Oh, my. Let's see. May I look at my CV?
Sure. With the court's permission.
Yes. Okay. Yes, from 1983 to 85, I was an assistant medical examiner for the city of St. Louis. Then in 87 to 91, I was the assistant medical examiner for the city of Philadelphia. 91 to 93, assistant medical examiner for the state of Delaware. And then 1993 to 2005, I was chief medical examiner for the state of Rhode Island.
Thank you for that. Dr. LaPosada, have you held any faculty positions as a in the field of forensic pathology that qualify you as an expert in this case?
Yes. Every medical examiner's office I worked in, I also had faculty appointments to teach medical students and pathology residents. So I had faculty appointments at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, at the Hospital University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and in Rhode Island.
Let's talk about those one at a time. Describe your teaching responsibilities at Brown Medical School, if you wouldn't mind. And that, by the way, that's from 1994 to present, correct?
93 to as a medical examiner, it was 1993 to 2005. And there I would teach the medical students. We had rotations through the medical examiner's office, and also the pathology residents would rotate through the medical examiner's office, where I would teach them how to do a medical legal autopsy, how to understand cause and manner of death, especially non-natural and traumatic deaths.
With regard to your teaching responsibilities specifically, are you still teaching?
I'm teaching in the cardiovascular section now. But since I'm not chief of the medical examiner's office, I obviously don't have students rotating through there anymore.
Were you a lecturer in the role of medical examiner? Did you do a seminar in that regard at or associated with Brown University School of Medicine?
Yes.
Did you do some sort of a forensic pathology rotation for pathology residents from 1994 to 1995 in that capacity as well?
Yes, we would have the pathology residents who were at the hospital studying anatomic pathology come to the medical examiner's office so they could understand the discipline of forensic pathology.
What is cardiomyopathy?
Cardiomyopathy is a muscular disease of the muscles of the heart.
And what is myocarditis?
Inflammation of the heart muscle.
Did you ever teach or lecture on those issues?
Yes, I teach every year. I teach the second year medical students about those heart diseases.
Have you ever taught anatomy and physiology to EMTs?
Yes.
Or in the EMT setting?
Yes.
And what about a class known as the 2-hour primer on forensic pathology?
I've taught a lot. I don't recall that particular.
How about pathology residents morning conference in 2009?
Oh, yes. I give lectures to the pathology residents at medical school, at Brown Medical School in forensic pathology.
You also mentioned that you were an adjunct professor biomedical forensic sciences and forensic anthropology in the Department of Anatomy and Neurology. Is that a division of the graduate school, Boston University School of Medicine?
Yes, I taught in the master's program in the medical school at Boston University School of Medicine for a master's in forensic science, where I taught a 40-hour course on forensic pathology and another 40-hour course on medical legal death investigation.
Were you actually the course director in that position?
Yes.
And were you also a course director in medical legal death investigation from 2006 to 2013?
Yes.
And what about a course director in forensic toxicology from 2006 to 2012?
Correct.
Did you direct the studies in biomedical forensic sciences, GMS, from 2012 to present?
Yes.
Describe that. What is that?
The graduate medical sciences?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I would review and be on the board to examine projects that the students were doing to get a master's degree.
Were you also an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine?
Yes.
Okay. Without going into every single class that you taught, did you teach from 1987 to 1991, attending staff medical pathology.
Yes.
What is that? Just a general outline of what that teaching course was.
When I was at the hospital, the University of Pennsylvania, I ran the autopsy service, so I taught medical students and pathology residents about autopsy practice.
I want to ask you sort of broadly, can you describe your major teaching and clinical responsibilities when you were at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in the field of forensic pathology? What were your main clinical and teaching positions?
Mm-hmm. Well, I ran the autopsy service there, so I taught the medical residents and medical students autopsy pathology, and I was also a assistant medical examiner there, so I taught the and started the forensic fellowship in forensic pathology.
Have you ever been qualified as an expert witness in forensic and anatomic pathology in state and federal courts?
Yes.
How many times would you say you've qualified as an expert?
Over 40 years, maybe several hundred.
How about in Massachusetts?
That includes all of them.
Okay. Have you ever qualified? Let me list a couple of states. In Massachusetts?
Yes.
California?
Yes.
Connecticut?
Yes.
Delaware?
Yes.
Florida?
Yes.
Illinois?
Yes.
Maryland?
Yes.
Minnesota?
Yes.
Missouri?
Yes.
New York?
Yes.
Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Rhode Island,
yes.
Have I left anything out?
Did you say Massachusetts?
I did.
Okay,
then you're fine. We started with Massachusetts.
Okay, you're fine.
What types of topics have you qualified to testify about as an expert forensic and anatomic pathologist?
Really anything that has to do with circumstances and cause of death. So it doesn't really matter, like, you know, what type of injury or a sudden unexpected death. Usually it involves examination, a study of information from the scene, information from the autopsy, police and investigation of medical records, and we put that all together and figure out the circumstances as to how someone died and why their body stopped functioning. So that's the basis of forensic pathology.
Dr. Williams, excuse me for just a second.
You're on a mute for one week.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills. so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You lather, rinse, moisturize, repeat, and repeat. But it never feels like enough. It's not your products. It's your water. Hard water leaves a mineral residue that clogs pores and dries out hair. Culligan water softeners remove damaging minerals, revitalizing brittle hair and dry skin. Upgrade your shower and skincare routine with Culligan. Water you love.